Welcome to Infinite Returns, Commercial Real Estate Investing, brought to you by Infinity Commercial Capital. We help people find money. We are investors, lenders, and financing advisors. And this podcast is about real estate investing and helping you. Whether it's investing in residential rental properties or commercial properties, we talk about lending and all things real estate. From newbie to experienced, from funding to the strategy it takes to find success. Welcome your host, Carl Baker.
Well, welcome to our show, Infinite Returns, a show about commercial real estate investing. I'm your host, Carl Baker, a real estate investor, a licensed CPA for over 30 years, and the CEO of Infinity Commercial Capital, the show's sponsor. At Infinity Commercial Capital, we help people find money, very simply. We're lenders and financing advisors. More about us later in the show. Before we get started, if you are watching the show via video, make sure that you like and follow the show, subscribe. If you're listening by video, by audio, then make sure you follow our show if you want to hear more of our future content. Today, I'm very excited. My guest is Brian Stone, a friend of mine in our community and a realtor and a real estate investor. So he is with Stone Estate Group, a real estate investor and Keller Williams realtor in Springfield, Missouri. We're going to talk about real estate investing, et cetera. We'll get into that. But Brian, hello, welcome to the show. And why don't you introduce yourself?
Thanks, Carl. First of all, I really appreciate you having me. You know what I mean? I'm excited to talk about real estate. I know that we've done it multiple times. We always have a good time, so it's going to be great. And I'll keep it short and sweet. You know, I do think all things real estate. I do the commercial space, residential space. I got into the industry not to turn on light switches or to be on Netflix or any of the things that some people associate with realtors. I got into real estate because truthfully, I had a passion for people and came from the HR background. And I'm passionate about people achieving their personal and professional goals. And let's be honest, Carl, every goal has some kind of financial tie or need to it. And I know no other vehicle to grow wealth that is quite like real estate. So that really brought me into the industry and I absolutely love it. Really love it. But yeah.
Well, that's an interesting thing. That last piece, I always touch on that. I think that if you're going to be an expert in something and you're going to spend all of your waking professional hours in something, it needs to be something that you like so that you can be passionate about it and remain committed and passionate about it. Otherwise, it's going to be tough. So that's an important piece that more and more people need to hear.
Well, and truthfully, I mean, I was talking to my 15-year-old son the other day, and it's like it dawned on him for the first time that, oh, you can work and it actually be fun. He was like asking me, Dad, you know, do you like work? Is work fun? Yeah, work is fun. It hasn't always been fun. I've done other jobs that weren't fun. But yeah, right now, work is a lot of fun.
It's still work, but yes, it certainly is work. It certainly is fun when you're doing something that you like. So that's great. Just to touch on that, I think it's important. And I've changed careers. You've changed careers, and much of that has to do with passion around our interests and skill sets, etc. So I just bring that up. All right. Well, so today's subject is real estate investing. And it's an interesting time. We're in early 2024, and the economy is interesting. Interest rates are up, and I get asked all the time, Brian, I'm betting you get asked all the time, is now a good time to buy? There are inventory issues. There are interest rate issues. In fact, people usually ask me, what are interest rates? And so what we're going to do in this show in the next few minutes is we're going to talk about that question, is now a good time to buy? And we're going to talk about how to analyze that question, but we're also then going to give some tidbits and some data, and not only how do we analyze that, but some thoughts around that. One of the things that Brian and I talked about in our prep was that question, is now a good time to buy? And being a lender, people naturally ask me about interest rates. And I remind people the when in a transaction, if you're purchasing, investing in real estate, the when is in the property acquisition. Interest rates are going to go up and down throughout the course of time, but the actual permanent component of the transaction is the real estate. So buy the real estate, and that's really the win, and don't focus so much on interest rate. But with that in mind, Brian, let's start talking about, is now a good time to buy? How do you want to get started?
Oh man, that's such a loaded question. It's also my favorite one, Carl. I mean, because that question requires so many more questions. In reality, it's like, well, what do you mean? But first of all, by what? By where? You know what I mean? And what are your personal investing goals? And what makes sense for you and your family? Right. So it's never a question that I can answer as a broad yes. Response. It's always a further conversation. And so I'm excited to jump into it.
Yeah, I think that's why we start with not answering that question, because you're not going to be able to answer it for me. I'm not going to be able to answer it for you and for any of our listeners. But it's really about understanding how to assess that for you. And one of the things that you said, not to steal your thunder, but was, if it's always a good time, and I liked your line, and making sure I'm giving you credit, it's always a good time to buy a good deal if you're a real estate investor. So that's a good way to say that. And you know, one of the other things we talked about, and we're kind of just diving into it, but I know you have some data you wanted to share, but if in today's rates, which are not, they're on the higher side, but they're not outrageously high. And I think that's important for people to understand. And we could show charts on that. But people got so accustomed to the 0% interest rates that today's Wall Street Journal prime rate of 8.5% seems out of this world. Historically, it's probably a little above average, but it's not outrageously, you know, 1970s highs. And so if you can fit a deal and make a deal work today, then eventually when rates go down, then your deal will be even that much better. And the win was when you purchased the real estate.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. You make your money on the way in. That's how investing works. You make your money on the way in. If you get the right property at the right price and you have the right strategy for that property, then you're in good shape, right? So, I mean, is your goal short-term, mid-term, long-term rental? Are you prioritizing cash flow or property appreciation? Are you prioritizing location and your proximity to it? Are you doing the own work? Are you subbing that out and having somebody else do whatever remodel work? Are you doing your own property management, or is somebody else doing the property management? All of those questions have to factor into you breaking down your numbers to identify whether or not it's the right time to buy for this particular property or that asset, right? And so, and we could dive into any number of those questions, but I would say it probably makes the most sense to just start about, you know, start looking at where we're at nationally, like what it looks like right now. And so let me actually pull that slide up if I can, Carl.
Yes.
So we've got, there we go. So this is actually, just a really, really broad look. And I want to start big and then we can go a little small. But this is just in the U.S. for where we're at right now. What does the affordability look like for real estate right now? And you can even see the breakdown right now. If you're in Ohio, it's pretty darn good. If you're in Iowa, West Virginia, Illinois, Indiana, all of those places have a really good affordability index. And they're looking at, in this data, they're looking at multiple different income levels. And they're looking at the active inventory and the price ranges that those are relative to the income of the individuals that live in that location. Okay, and that's important because you're only looking at the income for where those listings exist to create the relationship between affordability for the people that live there in the inventory that they have access to. So, and then obviously least affordable California, big surprise. Nobody surprised that's on there, but. Hawaii is one of them. Of course, you know, Hawaii is super, super expensive comparatively because there's not a lot of land. But the thing that people forget, though, is you don't have to buy where you live. Right. You can, as a real estate investor, you can go to these affordable outliers. And guess what? Your income in California can absolutely support a purchase in West Virginia or Iowa or Ohio. I have a lot of out-of-state investors that invest right here in our Southwest Missouri market because our taxes are super, super reasonable because we're non-disclosure. So we have way lower rates than even some of the more affordable states on this list, right? So there's all different kinds of places you can purchase. So that's why I said the question, is it the right time to buy? Well, where? Right? That matters.
Absolutely. I have a client that called me in from California wanting to buy a short-term rental property in Southern California, San Diego. And we talked briefly about purchase price and cash flows for a $2 million short-term rental property and how to fit that into a financing. And it's quite possible, but it's a lot easier to buy as nice of a house. It's probably not going to have the same ocean views, presumably, that has, but you're not buying it for your own ocean views. You're buying it for a commercial exercise. So finding properties that are more affordable and actually your wealth would probably grow by investing in smaller properties and invest. You can have more and probably grow your wealth with that $2 million in other ways in other states. So that's a great point.
Well, and it's diversification as well, right? If you have the ability to gain financing for or the capital for, $2 million worth of property, let's say, as an example, do you want to have $2 million properties in a market that is more susceptible to the highs and lows? Because let's be honest, percentages hit a million a whole lot different than they hit 500,000 or 200,000 or 100,000, right? So, or do you want to diversify that 2 million and maybe acquire, a package of 15 to 20 different properties that are all income producing? You spread your occupancy risk. You don't have to worry about turnover as much or having, high costs for remodels impacting your cash flow. I mean, there's lots of advantages there.
Absolutely. All right. Well, fantastic. What's the next data point that you have for us, Brian?
So that's national, right? And so yes. If we look and dial in a little bit more locally, we can look at the inventory. So this one actually shows our inventory levels for the three counties directly around where I'm at, Southwest Missouri. And I like going hyper local, right? So if we look at this, and it's a little bit harder to see on here, our month supply of inventory is sitting, right around three, it kind of fluctuates. Three last year, excuse me, we're at 2.1 this year. So we've gone down 1 month supply. And this chart, I don't love. I'd rather actually look at the month by month of the data. It's not a visual, but if you guys that are...
You can see the 2.1 there. Yeah.
Yeah, the 2.1. So yeah, it's a little bit better representation. So 2.1 here locally and 2.2 nationally. Truthfully, I'll start by saying a buyer's market is anything above 7 months supply of inventory, and a seller's market is anything below five. And technically, a balanced market is 6 months, right? But it never stays there very long. We have been in a seller's market for a decade, Carl. We've been in a seller's market. But that doesn't mean it's been the same for the past 10 years. We've had inventory rates be four and a half months, 3 months, and we've had them be as low as 0.5, 0.4, which, to put that into perspective, it means if no more listings came in on the market and we're at 0.5 month supply, it would only take 2 weeks with the current demand to absorb everything that the market has to offer. So obviously that's a very different story. So
it's an interesting point. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, if you look at it over the year, though, we've seen a lot of fluctuations with December of 2022 being the most memorable month for most of people within the industry, because that's when we really saw the rates come up in a really big way and the market just responded by having a lot of inventory sit and not sell. But it's really levelized back down to where we're still floating between 1.5 to about 2.5 months supply for most of the last 12 months.
We started this conversation by talking about how do we analyze whether it's a good deal. And I think now we've chosen to spend the rest of this show talking about single family residences. And just keep in mind, we're doing that to illustrate how to assess the good time and how to assess when it's a good time within the context of single family homes. And obviously we're not intentionally focusing on one community or another, wanting to talk broadly, but this is the kind of analysis you would do as a real estate investor when you're choosing a property type, an asset class, and a location, because it will be different. There's a lot of overarching trends that are the same, but then the details are in the locale. So I think this is a great analysis. Then just to bring in interest rates real briefly, there is, and then we'll move on to your next point, Brian. There is a lot of talk about whether interest rates will go down during 2024 and whether that will create whether that will trigger the release of pent-up demand for purchasing rental property properties for purposes of rental properties, whether that will create pent-up demand and whether that will then trigger high prices. But the offset to that is the inventory. So rates will go down, likely creating a lot of, if that was the only thing, home prices would probably go up. But then there's just also not a lot of inventory, and that also would create demand and create price increases, but the lack of inventory will hold back the ability to actually find properties. So that, I think there's a lot of lessons in here in a person's research and readiness for inventory for real estate investment.
Well, and I'll to your point there. I mean, I'm glad you brought that up, Carl. To your point, I think there's this misconception that if the inventory shifts, it's always going to be a negative thing, and that's not the case. And you know, if we see that demand go down, and that causes inventory levels to go up, every day you're in an up market is a day closer to a down market. And every day that you're in a down market is a day closer to an up market. It will shift back and forth. That is an inevitability. Mm-hmm. You can set your clock to it, right? Mm-hmm. The question is when. And if we look at this chart, I'll keep it up. Look all the way to December 22. Yes, we hit a spike in inventory at 3 months supply. It was the highest, even higher than anything nationally in the last 12 months. But look at what happened in January. The inventory literally got cut in half in 30 mm-hmm. days time, because mm-hmm. all of this inventory came up, and immediately what happened? Well, I will tell you, the investment minded individuals were still buying property in December when everybody else started backing out, single family or multifamily and otherwise. And so they mm-hmm. saw an opportunity with that inventory to be at the highest level it has been in a long time. Sellers were scared. Their realtors were probably scared because it wasn't selling in 2 days. If they're new to the market, they weren't used to that. And there's deals that got made in that 30 day span right there. So yeah, if we do see that happen in the next year, now listen, we could pontificate all day long, but I will tell you that my professional opinion would be if we see that happen, absolutely we're going to see a huge drop in inventory, because people are going to that pent up demand is going to come out there. Affordability is in a position now where people are having to choose to rent, not because they prefer to rent. A lot of investors are having to choose to hold on to properties instead of liquidating their properties because they feel the market isn't right. And so there will be some inventory creation that happens.
Fantastic point. Great. All right, Brian, next, I think you had some other data you wanted to share with us.
Yeah, I'll briefly talk to this. And this is kind of the even more hyper-local side of it, right? And so this is, and again, we could fill an hour just with charts. But this is the sales price to original price comparison. Again, this is focusing on single family properties as a case study, as an example. But we saw this with multifamily too. And this shows the relationship between where a home started in price and where it ended in price. So where did they list it and where did they actually land? Right. And so the left hand column shows homes that priced it effectively the first time. They did not have to have a price change. And on average, they got 98.5% almost percent of what they were asking for. So for every 100 grand in sales price, they got 98.4%. And that took them about 14 days to actually get an acceptable contract and proceed to closing. Now, the right hand side shows properties that missed the mark. They were sellers that were overambitious or inexperienced agents that don't know how to have pricing conversations. And that leaves you with a totally different story. You're leaving 10% on the table. The you ended about 89.9%. And so you're losing 10%, and the average days on market, by the way, is 62 days. So you lose 6 weeks, and what is that? 8.5%.
Yeah, right. About 8.5%.
And I mean, that's painful. And look, this is I like showing this because it shows the importance of pricing effectively if you're a seller. But also on the property acquisition side, it tells a story for what to look for as a buyer. If you see a property that's there and it's 30 plus days, especially if it's past that 60 day mark, you can now be an educated buyer. If this was your local market and your strategy to say, hey, just out of the gate, I need to be asking for at least a 10% discount on that price.
Right. I think one of the things that we talked about was this is a seller's analysis, but like anything, the more educated a person is entering into a transaction as a borrower, buyer, whatever, I talk about it from a lending perspective, be educated and position yourself and understand what how the other side thinks. So how does a lender think as a borrower? How does a buyer How does a seller think as a real estate buyer? And so that's a great analysis to pick up on that and understand if there is an opportunity there. If you were to fully go into that, you would see that seller that had to drop the price, we talked about this offline, Brian, that seller ends up ultimately selling that property for less than what they would have done if they had just priced it right out of the gate. And that's opportunity cost, not only in time, but in real dollars. And if you're a buyer, understanding that and taking advantage of that is important.
Well, I mean, and I think the scenario that we kind of walked through offline, I'm happy to go through the numbers there if it would benefit your listeners too, is, you know, if let's say a property should be at 300,000 and let's say it's a duplex, just your standard duplex and these numbers apply, right? If it was needed to be priced at 300 and that's what the comps provided, that's what the market was telling us, and you were at or below that, then you would end up, netting more than if you threw it on the market at 325 and then took a 10% or more discount, right? And that's not even to bring in terms, right? Because, you know, you want the best terms possible. If you're a buyer, you want to have the best price. You want to get all the bells and whistles. Even as an investor, as is offers are really common, but if you can get the seller to do repairs, maybe put on a new roof, put in an insurance claim, things like that, that's all beneficial. And if that property misses on price and starts too high, you're just opening the door for a buyer to take you to the cleaners and ask everything that they possibly can ask of you, right? Nobody wants to be in that position unless you're the buyer, right?
right. Of course. Well, fantastic. Let's see here. Do you want to spend, we talked about the sales original price. Do you want to spend a few minutes? We talked about the broad. We've talked about the single family home. Let's spend a few minutes talking about short-term rentals, because we won't be able to dive fully into that. But in context of today's market, understanding how to assess a deal, whether it's the right time to buy, you have some experience with short-term rentals. I have a little bit of experience, certainly from an investing standpoint and also from a lending standpoint. So let's just talk about some of the different risks and ways to evaluate, is now the right time to buy in the short-term rental space?
So I think that's an even more difficult question to answer, and one that requires more questions. But I'm glad you brought it up, because it's higher risk in the short-term market, but also a higher opportunity for gain when done properly. You know, because mm-hmm. you take a property that would otherwise bring in maybe $900 to $1,000 in rent, and maybe you're cash flow positive, at least $200, or you shouldn't be buying it, maybe $300 or $400, right? And that same property, if it's prime for a short term rental, could generate more like $2,500 to $3,500 a month in a good month in the short term rental market, right? The same exact property. But there's a lot of things to be aware of that I think people don't think about. Furnishing is a huge part of it. And, in my experience, you're looking at, roughly, for an 1800 square foot property, you're probably looking to spend $18,000, has been my general rule. And what is that? Is that $10 per square foot? Is that about, did I do my math right? Or is that an extra zero?
It's $10. Yeah.
So I think as a good general rule, if you're going into a potential nightly opportunity, you should plan to spend at least $10 per square foot just in furnishing. Because it's everything, right? I got to have knives, cutting boards. I got to have, wine glasses, scotch glasses, whatever, right? I think the thing that people do incorrectly too is they don't think about the story of the nightly rental, because it has to be an engaging enough property to pull someone from all of the other potential opportunities for lodging and cause them to come and stay at your personal property and pay cleaning fees and pay, hotel taxes and all that stuff on top of it. And most people don't. They don't consider all of those factors, and they finish it out the way that they think they should. And I'll give you a perfect example. I've got a property that's, we just closed out the year 2023. That property generated about $45,000 in revenues in Branson, Missouri, and it is a 3-bedroom that sleeps 10. I will tell you right now, if you wanted to book it, it's like $94 a night, because nobody books in January in Branson, right? Your occupancy is really hurt by seasonality. And so that's a good example of a good property. But to get that, I basically had to say no to all of the things that everybody else, including my property manager, was recommending. They're saying, well, you have carpet, you need to change it to hardwood flooring. Look at all of these comps and see how they did. It was like, yeah, but I'm not selling a house. I'm not doing a rental property. I'm curating an experience. So I want mine to look different than the 30 other properties. So I'm going to keep the carpet. I'm not going to replace the cabinets. I'm going to eat the cost of, carpet cleaning, because the look and feel will make it stand out in the search when people are going through click by click by click. So there's a learning curve there.
There's a learning curve. And I think the overarching principle there is that there is a difference in investing in that asset class compared to investing in the long-term single-family home rental space, or even multifamily. It is more of a business operation than certainly, I believe all of it is a business, but the skill set, the expertise, the time involved, the risk assessment is different for short-term rentals.
It's interesting. It's what some people seek, right? I mean, because the whole goal is build passive wealth. If you want passive wealth, you know, buy a 16 unit apartment complex and then have it completely operated by somebody else so that you can that you trust, so that you can completely step away. You know, nightly rentals are way more active than that. But I think to circle back to your question, is now the right time to buy for a short term rental? I think the answer to that is yes, if you have the proper exit strategy. And by that, I mean, if it doesn't perform in the way that you need to, can it be a midterm rental? And if not, can it be a long-term rental, right? Or does it have an equity position that would allow you to sell it for a return and do a 1031 exchange and put it into something else without it being a high risk of fluctuation in terms of value? Is the value of that property coming from the projected potential return on the nightly market? Or is it a solid value that's based on comps for homes, regardless of whether they're income producing? So those are the questions that really dictate whether or not it's a good purchase.
And I think it comes back to in some of that assessment is locale, because there are some markets that naturally lend itself towards a short-term rental spot, short-term rental market. Something, for example, properties close to major hospitals, properties close to potentially close to universities, could be short or midterm markets. And understanding how the economy is in those locales will help you understand whether now is the right time. And I think go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, the base of that economy, right? Like, what's the anchor? You know, for our two base industries for my market are major medical and secondary education. And guess what? Those things, even in a down market, they are supported by the federal government. They're supported. They're always going to be universally needed. So that market area might have a different level of risk than somebody than a market that's maybe all anchored on the hotel industry or all anchored on the automobile industry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And understanding that locale. I just wanted to make another point, and I think we'll wrap this up and talk about some concluding points. And that is, when you talked about the exit strategy, I love the way you articulate that. What is your exit strategy? How could you convert that asset class to something else? And I'll just tell you, as a lender, what many lenders do, if they are even in the market to lend to short-term rentals, and if they are, they recognize that there's a different risk profile. They want to understand what a borrower's experience is, but then they might underwrite to that exit plan more so than to the actual expected cash flows of the property. So what do I mean by that? If a person is entering into a transaction to purchase a single family home for to be used for a short-term rental, there might be an expectation, let's just say it's a $200,000 property and you're going to rent it for $6,000 a month on a short-term rental basis. Well, the underwriter might say, okay, if you have historical cash flows that last for years, we might underwrite to that. But we might, instead of that, we might underwrite to your exit plan, which would be to convert that to a long-term rental space. So what would a long-term rental rate be for that property if you were to just scrap your short-term rental plans and just make it a long-term rental? What would that be? $1,500, $2,000? Then we'll size the underwriting and the loan amount into that cash flow. And just to be honest, that can materially change the underwriting and change the principal balance. But that is the way certain lenders will do that if they're more conservative. And just raising awareness about that. But another way to say that is, lenders There is business risk, especially in the short-term rental space. There's business risk. Lenders are taking lending risk, not business risk. And so if they determine that the maximum lending risk is that ultimate exit plan, then the rest of that is business risk. And if you can get the short-term rentals, then great, but the lending will cap at the lending risk. I just think that's an interesting analysis.
Yeah, I mean, I love that you brought that up, Carl. It kind of comes back to what you initially said at, you know, when we first started the conversation, which was if you can make a deal work in today's market, then you're even more favorable in the future. It's the same concept, right? If you can, if the deal works in the exit strategy, which is a lower cash flow or lower gain, then for sure it's going to work at the higher gain. So, I mean, it's the same concept. I like that you make the analogy of business risk versus financing risk, because there is a difference. And I think that investors who are not in the financial space like yourself, they're only looking at the business risk. They're not thinking about the financial risk associated with that. And if they had more of a mindset of a lender when they approached a deal, they would probably save a lot of their time, and they would only bring deals that were more viable, and everybody would be more happy. You wouldn't be trying to bounce from, you know, person to person to try and get a deal done. You can call somebody you trust that you know is business minded as well as financially minded, and everything else is smoother.
Well, I mean, that's a conversation in and of itself. That falls under the concept of financing positioning, understanding how a lender thinks, and then readying yourself with that understanding in the scenario that you're navigating. So it is a fascinating subject, and I think it's incredibly important. I do get a lot of phone calls from people that aren't quite position. They're not quite ready, not at all that they can't get through the loan, but there's more education needed. And perhaps some surprise when we talk about the fact that we're not taking that business risk, we're taking the lending risk. And it's up to you to take that business risk. And understanding that, I think, is incredibly important. Yeah. Well, very good. Let's talk about, let's wrap this up before we let people know how to find you. I like to end the show with a few lessons. What are the overarching points that we can glean from this? What I glean from it is, well, let me just stop there and just ask you, what are a couple of points that you have, Brian?
So, I think some things that I learned from the conversation is, or rather reiterated, is come from a financing perspective. If the deal makes sense in your exit strategy, then it'll make sense for your primary strategy. That's right. Absolutely a takeaway that I think I'm going to pass along with my team. And then past that, I think before asking the question, you have to understand the questions behind the questions, right? And you have to get down to what your strategy is, because if you don't have a strategy, then anybody's answers are the right answers and also the wrong answers, right?
You get pulled along,
you have
right?
You have to have a clear vision on what your individual risk tolerance is and what your individual strategy can be. And if you don't know what that is, I would say this is my big takeaway, is be learning based. Be willing to let your pride go, be willing to have conversations, listen to podcasts, watch YouTube, get your content from trustworthy sources, but get your content. And I'm a big Stoic philosopher, follower kind of guy. And so I'll say, one of my favorite quotes on this topic is actually from Epictetus. I'll quiz you on how to spell it in a second, Carl, but it is that a man cannot learn what he believes he already knows.
Right.
So take your pride out of it. Start digging in and learning more. I have a lot to learn in this space, and always will. You know, that's part of it.
Well, that's a great point. When we are students as children, we're sort of forced into learning in the academic setting. And the hope is that, yes, you learn some basics, but what you really learn is how to learn, and you gain an interest to continue learning. I mean, I learn way more now and enjoy learning more now than I did in a school setting. I did fine in school, but what it really taught me was to have a passion for learning, and that gets carried on forever.
Absolutely.
A couple of the lessons, you picked up on some of the lessons I did. The only other one was the importance of having that interest, but also the importance of locale. Because the economy might be different in certain places than in other places. And I think that's important to understand, that California investor may have other opportunities in Ohio or Missouri or Wyoming, whatever. And just understanding that locale. So I think that's another point. You touched on all the other ones that I have. Any other, if you have a final piece of advice, and then we'll let people know how to find you, Brian.
Look, this is going to sound super self-motivated, because it kind of is. Use professionals. That's my last thing. I mean, if you use professionals, use a financial professional, use a real estate professional. Use people that their one and only job is to make sure that you're protected. Obviously, mm-hmm. vet them and make sure that they're good. And look, it doesn't have to be me. Even if you're in my local market, there's a lot of great agents and brokers that are out there that can represent you well. Just make sure that you have proper representation, especially if you're investing in a location that is not your own.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, we've both said that we are real estate investors, and that's one way to be in the real estate industry. But there are other ways to be in the real estate industry, the realty space, the advisory space, the lending space. Those are all ways to participate. And there is niche expertise in all of those ways, which helps everybody in the industry. So great point.
Absolutely.
All right, Brian, where can people find you? Do you want me to give your website, or why don't you just do it? Give your website, phone number, email address, and anything else.
Yeah, it's, stonerealty.org. That's O-R-G. I think you can also get there by putting in Brian, B-R-I-A-N dot stonerealty.org. But look, you guys can find me wherever I'm at. I'm all over social media. I'm at Realtor Brian Stone on Facebook. That's probably where I'm the most active. And I am probably the best example of an anti-hustle realtor out there. I really mean that. It doesn't mean that I don't support my client's interest and I don't jump when I need to, but understand that mm-hmm. I'm not going to pressure you into a sales conversation. If you guys have a question about real estate or a question about the local market that I serve, or if you're needing a connection for a great agent that's in an outside market, just shoot me a message. Anywhere you find me, I'll get back to you.
Well, that's a great point, and interesting, the importance of professional networking. So that's great. I don't remember if you mentioned LinkedIn. I'm sure that we can find you on LinkedIn or Facebook.
Yeah, LinkedIn, Facebook. I'm on TikTok. I mean, I'm on everything vertical and horizontal. I've got a profile except for
you're
Twitter.
Everywhere.
Or Twitter or X.
X.
Yeah, I don't mess. That's not my space. But everywhere else, I've got a profile. I guarantee it.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I totally understand all of those things. All right. Well, so I'm going to thank you very much, Brian. I'm going to highlight to our audience just a little bit about Infinity Commercial Capital, our show's sponsor. I'm the CEO of Infinity Commercial Capital. We said earlier that Infinity Commercial Capital helps people find money. We're lenders and financing advisors providing permanent bridge construction capital solutions for commercial enterprises, commercial exercises, from 1 to 4 unit rental properties to multifamily properties to all manner of commercial real estates, malls, anything, mobile home parks, etc. Our several main value propositions include the following. We represent you, the borrower, as opposed to the lending entity. We represent you, the borrower. We have We feature 30-year fixed-rate commercial loans, which lowers the debt service. So I think that's important. That longer amortization means lower debt service. Bridge loans for residential and commercial properties. And simplified underwritings. For the most part, usually no tax returns, no personal debt-to-income ratio requirements, no global cash flow analysis. We're really asset-based lenders based on the specific deal. You can find more about us at infinitycomcapital.com. Call us at 314-403-7745. Email us at info@infinitycomcapital.com. I think my name will also be show up in the outro. You can, like Brian said, you can find us on all manner of social media, Facebook, LinkedIn. We are on Twitter, X, Instagram. We're usually posting articles, current rates, other educational content. We're on there a lot. Like I said at the beginning, if you like our show, hit subscribe, follow our show. We will have great content coming up in the future. If you have questions or if you want to be on the show, give us a comment. If it's particularly about this show, Brian and or I will make sure that we respond to that. We'll happily respond to your feedback and get back with you. We have great content coming up. We're going to be talking very soon about equity fundraising and other things. So thanks for watching, listening to our show, and we look forward to bringing you new content very shortly. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Questions, comments, want to be a guest? You can reach Carl at kbaker@infinitycomcapital.com. You can find all episodes of Infinite Returns Commercial Real Estate Investing on all major podcast platforms and YouTube. Thank you for tuning in. And until next time, happy investing.